Today, Pastor Zach begins a series on the book of Job. The introductory first two chapters, which I will read, set the scene and the events for the rest of this poetic book. This is a difficult section of scripture, I think, both perplexing and heartbreaking, which raises hard questions that won't be fully answered for us this side of eternity. Even so, we see here a man who, despite bewildering loss and grief, continues to cling to God and trust in his goodness. Job chapter 1, and you can follow in your pew Bibles if you like. There was a man in the land of Uz whose name was Job, and that man was blameless, upright, fearing God and turning away from evil. 7 sons and 3 daughters were born to him. His possessions also were 7,000 sheep, 3,000 camels, 500 yoke of oxen, 500 female donkeys, and very many servants. And that man was the greatest of all the men of the East. His sons used to go and hold a feast in the house of each one on his day, and they would send and invite their 3 sisters to eat and drink with them. When the days of feasting had completed their cycle, Job would send and consecrate them, rising up early in the morning and offering burnt offerings according to the number of them all. For Job said, "Perhaps my children have sinned and cursed God in their hearts." Thus Job did continually. Now, there was a day when the sons of God came to present themselves before the Lord, and Satan also came among them. The Lord said to Satan, "From where do you come?" Then Satan answered the Lord and said, "From roaming around on the earth and walking around on it." The Lord said to Satan, "Have you considered my servant Job? For there is no one like him on the earth, a blameless and upright man, fearing God and turning away from evil." Then Satan answered the Lord, "Does Job fear God for nothing? Have you not made a hedge about him and his house and all he has on every side? You have blessed the work of his hands, and his possessions have increased in the land. But put forth your hand now and touch all that he has. He will surely curse you to your face." Then the Lord said to Satan, "Behold, all that he has is in your power. Only do not put forth your hand on him." So Satan departed from the presence of the Lord. Now on the day when Job's sons and his daughters were eating and drinking wine in their oldest brother's house, a messenger came to Job and said, "The oxen were plowing and the donkeys feeding beside them, and the Sabaeans attacked and took them. They also slew the servants with the edge of the sword, and I alone have escaped to tell you." While he was still speaking, another also came and said, "The fire of God fell from heaven and burned up the sheep and the servants and consumed them, and I alone have escaped to tell you." While he was still speaking, another messenger also came and said, "The Chaldeans formed 3 bands and made a raid on the camels and took them and slew the servants with the edge of the sword, and I alone have escaped to tell you." While he was still speaking, another also came and said, "Your sons and your daughters were eating and drinking wine in their oldest brother's house. And behold, a great wind came from across the wilderness and struck the 4 corners of the house. And it fell on the young people, and they died. and I alone have escaped to tell you." Then Job arose and tore his robe and shaved his head and fell to the ground and worshipped. He said, "Naked I came from my mother's womb, and naked I shall return. The Lord gave, and the Lord has taken away. Blessed be the name of the Lord." Through all this, Job did not sin, nor did he blame God. Chapter 2. Again there was a day when the sons of God came to present themselves before the Lord, and Satan also came among them to present himself before the Lord. The Lord said to Satan, "Where have you come from?" Then Satan answered the Lord and said, "From roaming around on the earth and walking around on it." The Lord said to Satan, "Have you considered my servant Job? For there is no one like him on the earth, a blameless and upright man, fearing God and turning away from evil. And he still holds fast his integrity, although you incited me against him to ruin him without cause." Satan answered the Lord and said, "Skin for skin. Yes, all that a man has he will give for his life. However, put forth your hand now and touch his bone and his flesh. He will curse you to your face. So the Lord said to Satan, "Behold, he is in your power. Only spare his life." Then Satan went out from the presence of the Lord and smote Job with sore boils from the sole of his foot to the crown of his head. And Job took a potsherd to scrape himself while he was sitting among the ashes. Then his wife said to him, "Do you still hold fast your integrity? Curse God and die." But he said to her, "You speak as one of the foolish women speaks. Shall we indeed accept good from God and not adversity?" In all this, Job did not sin with his lips. Now when Job's three friends heard of all this adversity that had come upon him, they came, each one from his own place: Eliphaz the Temanite, Bildad the Shuhite, and Zophar the Naamathite. And they made an appointment together to come to sympathize with him and comfort him. When they lifted up their eyes at a distance and did not recognize him, they raised their voices and wept. And each of them tore his robe, and they threw dust over their heads towards the sky. Then they sat down on the ground with Job for 7 days and 7 nights, with no one speaking a word to him, for they saw that his pain was very great.
I shall now proceed to completely answer every question any of you might have about this text. Yeah. Hopefully, I will at least partially answer the central question of this text, which is not actually about suffering per se, so much as it is about wisdom in the face of suffering. This isn't a book about why God allows suffering. It's a book about how to deal with the reality that God allows suffering. It's a book of wisdom. I had a lesson in wisdom when I was about 8 years old. My grandfather decided to teach me how to chop wood, and he was a big believer in frustration as a learning tool. So he took me out to his woodpile, and he took a likely-looking log, and he laid it on the chopping block like so, and he handed the axe to me and said, "Have at it, Zachary." I understood intuitively that my manhood was at stake. So I went after it. I swung as hard as I could again and again and again, 10, 15, 20 times, and I barely made a dent. And then he said, "Pass me the axe, grandson." And I passed him the axe, and he took that piece of wood and stood it up and split it in two with one blow. And the lesson sunk in. Chopping wood works better if you go with the grain. That's what the Bible calls wisdom. Wisdom means that God has designed the universe to work in certain ways. Wisdom means that virtue is practical. That life will be better if you go with the grain by listening rather than assuming you already know everything. If you work hard rather than slacking off. If you are faithful to your spouse rather than sleeping around. That's wisdom. Live with the grain. Job is a book about the knots in the wood. About what happens when the grain is twisted and runs in unexpected or even unfair directions. Job's a book about the times in life when you swing well and swing wisely and the wood just grabs the axe and won't let go of it, or shunts the axe out the side of the block and it ends up in your shin instead. Job is a book about wisdom in the face of suffering. And so it's a book that asks the question, how do we live in a world of twisted grain? And we're going to do two things this morning. The first is I'm going to retell the story that Michelle just read. There's a reason that God gives us a story instead of like a blog post, 7 steps on living well in the midst of suffering. And I'm going to tell the story out of order. You noticed perhaps that it alternates in the book between earth and heaven, and then earth again. We're going to do all the earth scenes first, because that's all that Job knew. And we want to experience what he experienced, and then we'll get to the heavenly scenes. So we're going to retell the story, and then come back to the question, how do we live wisely in the face of suffering? What is wisdom in the midst of the ashes of life? Okay, telling the story. The first earthly scene in chapter 1, verses 1 to 5, it's a scene of things the way they should be. Job is a wise man, and he is reaping the rewards of wisdom. So verse 1 describes Job as blameless and upright, one who fears God and turns away from evil. That's pretty much perfect biblical language for a wise man. Okay? Blameless here doesn't mean flawless. It's not that Job is perfect. It's that he handles not being perfect well. When he does wrong, he's quick to apologize and make amends. He has integrity. Upright is the same word for justice. It refers to how he deals with the people around him, particularly those in his power. It means Job takes good care of his servants. He pays them well and honors them instead of exploiting them. One who fears God, the Bible calls the fear of God the beginning of wisdom. It means that Job has a proper understanding of his place and God's place. He knows that God is God and he is not. He respects God's power over his life. He doesn't pretend to be an independent, self-made man. He gets that all this stuff he has is a gift from on high. And turning away from evil means that Job's integrity has been tested. He's had opportunities to do wrong and hasn't taken advantage. He's a guy who keeps his hand out of the cookie jar even when nobody is looking or keeping count. Job is a wise man. He lives with the grain, and things are going well. He has an abundance of firewood stacked up. Verses 2 to 5, they paint this picture of all the rewards you would expect for wisdom. He's got material and relational prosperity. It's the last scene in whatever your favorite uplifting movie is. All is well. Job is wise, and wisdom has its rewards. That's the first scene. The second scene could not be more different. Everything falls apart for Job in one awful day. Did you get the relentlessness of that scene? Four disasters. Each of them, all by itself, enough suffering for a whole lifetime. One after the other, like waves of a hurricane. And there's no rhyme or reason to them. It's not like they're connected. Two of them are the wicked fruit of wicked people, and two of them are what insurance agents would rightly call acts of God. But the sum total of them is that Job is completely bereft. All the peace and prosperity that he had been enjoying, it's just gone. On the day before this day, Job was a wise and decent person whose life made sense. On this day, Job is still a wise and decent person. But there's no longer any sense to his life at all. Out of nowhere, he finds himself living amidst the ashes of everything he had faithfully and wisely built. We don't know how long passes between the second scene and the third scene. We aren't told. But in the third scene, the one thing apparently left to Job, his health, his physical well-being, is just as totally wrecked as his financial and familial well-being were in the second scene. He is ruined from the scalp of his head to the soles of his feet. Now there's really nothing left. Chapter 2, verse 8 says he sat down in the ashes, which means the garbage heap where they would burn all the refuse outside of town. It's exactly the place Jesus refers to again and again as a picture of hell. And really, I can't imagine using any less strong word than hell to describe where Job finds himself. I mean, are we really going to just call it adversity or trials? That doesn't get at it at all. So life has turned upside down and inside out for Job. He did everything he could to live wisely, to build his house on the rock, and the storm still swept him out to sea. And now he's adrift. No land in sight, treading water, exhausted. No real hope for anything except shedding more tears and dwelling on awful memories. His wife advises him to give up and go ahead and end his life. Some old friends, bless them, show up and sit with him in silence, but they can't help. And that's it. That's the end of the earthly scenes. Can you imagine being Job? Or how about this? If you were one of the friends, what would you say to comfort? That's the earthly scenes. Now we turn to the heavenly scenes. We're given a peek behind the curtain of what's going on that Job is not given, at least at this point. In the first heavenly scene, in the middle of chapter 1, God is holding court. And the sons of God, which is it means lesser spiritual beings that do God's bidding, they're sort of like God's the president and these are his cabinet ministers. They're all coming and making their reports to God the king. And Satan is one of these sons of God, and he comes to make his report. Satan, in Hebrew, the word means the accuser. It's actually not a name, it's a title. And it's a fitting title. It seems that Satan's job is basically the district attorney, and man, is he a corrupt district attorney? He is skeptical of everyone and wants everybody in as much trouble as possible so that he can accrue as much power as possible. The accuser comes forward to report, and God points to somebody he shouldn't be skeptical of. He points to Job. It says, I mean, have you checked this guy out? Here's somebody with integrity. And Satan, he doesn't deny what God is saying, but he asks a penetrating question in verse 9. Does Job fear God for no reason? Have you not put a hedge around him and his house and all that he has on every side? In other words, Satan is saying, yeah, sure, Job does the right thing, but bully for him. He knows that if he keeps his hand out of the Oreo jar, you're going to give him a dozen fresh-baked ginger snaps. Where's the integrity in that? What you call Job's integrity is just enlightened self-interest. And God answers, fair enough. Let's see what Job's really made of. And that's what sets the stage for Satan to strip Job of his children and his livelihood. The second heavenly scene is almost a carbon copy of the first. At this point, Job has been tested by Satan, and he passed with flying colors. God makes that clear in chapter 2, verse 3. It's almost as if he's taunting Satan. And the Lord said to Satan, have you considered my servant Job, that there is none like him on the earth, a blameless and upright man who fears God and turns away from evil? He still holds fast his integrity, although you incited me against him to destroy him without reason. Satan's plan is backfiring all over him, but he doesn't get it. He doubles down. He asks for permission to torture Job even more. And God says, okay. He says, behold, Job is in your hand. Only spare his life. And Satan departs from God's presence, sure that now he can get Job to curse God to God's face. And he attacks him with boils and leaves him in constant physical pain. It doesn't work. Job endures. So that's the story, with all its twisted grain, with all its ashes. When we just look at the earthly scenes, it's like listening in to half a telephone conversation, but the conversation is also in a language you barely know. I share an office with Moy Soriano, who's a Spanish pastor, and sometimes he's on the phone speaking to somebody in Spanish, and I really have no idea what's going on. I learned a little Spanish 15 years ago. We get the heavenly scenes, and it means that we get the whole conversation, but the language is still strange. The words and logic and flow of the story leave us bewildered. So, what are we to make of it? What does living well even mean in a world where Satan does God's bidding? Or to put it another way, in a world where God permits Satan's evil schemes? What is wisdom in the midst of the ashes? In wisdom literature in general, there are two paths. The path of the wise person and the path of the fool. And we're given both paths here. Job, of course, is the wise person. It's actually Satan who is the fool. Now, Satan is terribly clever. I don't mean to imply that he isn't. But he's still a fool. I mean, his very name betrays him, his title, the accuser. He is the consummate skeptic. The person who consistently and obsessively doubts everyone's motives. And by that, of course, I mean everyone's motives except his own. In Satan's eyes, God is naive, and Job is manipulative, and only he is left to see things rightly and tell the true story. Satan presumes to see through everyone else, but never stops to see his own stupidity. This foolishness, this relentless accusation, I fear, is the spirit of our age. So the conservative mocks the liberal, and the liberal contemptuously ignores the conservative, and the moderate stands stricken in the middle, sighing, "If only more people were wise and nuanced like me." The atheist derides the Christian. "How can your good and powerful God allow evil like this that we see all around us?" And the Christian sneers back, "Tell me again where in your theory of evolution you find justification for calling anything evil? Isn't it all just natural selection?" The husband shouts at his wife, "If you loved me, you would not nag me this much." And the wife blasts back, "If you were worth loving, it wouldn't take so much nagging." We all have this inner fool, this inner accuser to keep us company at night, to help us in those imaginary debates with our enemies where we righteously slay them with the sword of truth and justice, and thanks to our perfect integrity, we suffer no wounds at all ourselves. That's just me then? I'm the only one who does that? I'm really good at those debates. We all have this tendency. And to all of us, Jesus says the same thing. Why do you see the speck that is in the other person's eye and never notice the log that is in your own eye? If you're going to be skeptical, how about you start with being skeptical of your own assumptions, your own preferences, your own desires? I saw a bumper sticker the other day driving down Circle that said, "Don't trust everything you think." That sounds like something Jesus would say. That sounds like wisdom. And remember, Satan is not just skeptical of other people, he's even skeptical of God. But God is in heaven, and you are on earth. He may give you a glimpse behind the curtain from time to time, but he lives there. Now look, God designed you to wonder and to try to understand. So go ahead and ask your questions. Even the questions, like Michelle said, that will not be fully answered in this lifetime. But ask them knowing the limits of your understanding. Not expecting to get a nice, clean blog post answer. God knows everything about everyone. And you don't even know yourself. Only fools like Satan presume to accuse God, presume to charge God with wrong. Nonetheless, the temptation to accuse God is overwhelming sometimes. I mean, we're doing chapters 1 and 2 today of a 42-chapter book, and almost the entire rest of the book is Job wrestling with the temptation to accuse God, to charge him with wrong. And really, I mean, how could he not, given what he's been through? Elie Wiesel, a survivor of the death camp at Auschwitz, tells the story of some of the other people in his camp who, in order to console themselves in the midst of the ashes, put God on trial, leveled against them the charge of having abandoned his people. Now, they knew that whatever verdict they found, they'd have no power to enforce it, but nonetheless, they end up finding God guilty. Who doesn't sympathize with that? Who doesn't, at least some of the time, in the midst of this wicked world, in the midst of all these ashes, want to lay the charges at God's feet? I mean, what else are we supposed to do when a little boy gets leukemia? What else are we supposed to do when a whole city is leveled by an earthquake? When a young girl runs away from her abusive home only to be snatched up by a trafficker and put to work in a brothel? When whole peoples are turned into refugees by war or famine? Where else is there to lay the charges? At least some of the time, every honest person feels the pull of the simple logic. The world makes no sense. Therefore, God, its maker, is not sensible. In Job, we have a man who knows that pull better than any of us, who is pulled to and fro over the face of the earth by the temptation of that logic, and yet still finds his way to wisdom. We're told in the face of all these disasters, Job does not sin in his response, and specifically in chapter 1, verse 22, he does not charge God with wrong. Job's way is the way of wisdom, even wisdom in the face of bewildering pain. When our lives or the lives of our loved ones are burnt to ashes, Job shows us the way to be wise. Specifically, he shows us that wisdom amidst the ashes means lament and worship. Lament and worship. Wisdom amidst the ashes means lament. Lament is honest grief and honest confusion directed toward God. When Job experiences these disasters, he weeps. He shaves his head and rends his garments and falls down in the dust. His heartbreak is on display. Job doesn't hide behind a stiff upper lip. He doesn't realize that it's Sunday morning, so he'd better put on a smile and get ready to say platitudes like, "I know this is a hard season, but I'm victorious in Jesus, so what do I really have to be sad about?" He doesn't console himself by running out to buy a coffee mug that has Jeremiah 29:11 on it. Job groans. He laments. He wears his sorrows on his shredded sleeve. Learn from his example. Sometimes the wise thing to do is break down, to sob, to sit silently, because you cannot summon the energy to utter a word. Don't be afraid of this. Certainly, don't be ashamed of this. The world is not okay. It is not your job to pretend to be okay in it all the time. To be always ready to respond to that question, "How are you?" with, "I'm well, how are you?" I was reflecting on this morning and listening to a song Andrew Peterson wrote during an extended period of depression. I'm going to read the opening lyrics. "I tried to be brave, but I hid in the dark. I sat in that cave and I prayed for a spark to light up all the pain that remained in my heart. And the rain kept falling. Down on the roof of the church where I cried, I could hear all the laughter and love, and I tried to get up and get out, but a part of me died. And the rain kept falling down. Well, I'm scared if I open myself to be known, I'll be seen and despised and be left all alone. So I'm stuck in this tomb, and you won't move the stone. And the rain keeps falling. Somewhere the sun is a light in the sky, but I'm dying in North Carolina, and I can't believe there's an end to the season of night. And the rain keeps falling down. Now, that's a song of weakness. It's also a song of wisdom. Sometimes weakness is wisdom. So go ahead and lament. In this world of ashes, it's the wise thing to do. Amidst the ashes, wisdom means lament. Wisdom also means worship. They go together. Chapter 1, verse 20. Then Job arose and tore his robe and shaved his head and fell on the ground and worshiped. What is worship? What does that mean? In English, it comes from an old word, worth-ship, or how worthy something is. Whatever you think is worth most, that's what you worth-ship. It could be God. It could also be, you know, country or family or career or a good burger or Beavers baseball. But we all worth-ship something. We all find something most worthy. This is what the debate in heaven between God and Satan was about, whether or not Job really worshiped God or actually worshiped the good things that God was giving him. And the answer is revealed in chapter 1, 21, where shaved and stripped, bereft of his life work, of his pride and joy, Job cries out, "Naked I came from my mother's womb, and naked shall I return. The Lord gave, and the Lord has taken away. Blessed be the name of the Lord." In this moment, naked, having lost all the other good things in his life, Job affirms God's singular worth. He doesn't value God as an instrument, as a means to some other end, right? To prosperity or family harmony or a sense of purpose in his life or inner peace. He values God for God's own self. He genuinely worships God. Now, this was true, it seems, before Job faced these disasters. But the disasters revealed and refined Job's worship in a way the good life never could. Just like a storm reveals and refines a ship captain's skill in a way that calm seas never will. Only in the midst of the waves is Job unveiled. Only in the midst of this mess and these ashes is his wisdom strengthened. The disaster actually makes Job wiser. And it makes Job wiser because it fixes his worship on God. So, what do we worship? Is it God? God all alone? God apart from all the other good things he might give us? Who gets our worship? Or are we fixed on some of those good things? Or, this is actually what I suspect is true for most of us, are we undecided? Have we yet to really choose between God and comfort? God and privacy? God and being right? We all worship something. The question is, what is it? If we find ourselves in that undecided, unsettled state, then will we have the courage to ask God to make us wise, to refine and reveal our worship? Wisdom amidst the ashes, it means lament. And it means worship. And these These two pillars of wisdom support one another like two pillars or two sides of an arch coming together. The only thing that can keep lament in this world of ashes from sliding into despair is worship of a God who transcends this life and yet is present in the midst of this life. And the only thing that can keep worship of a true and powerful God grounded in the real world is honest lament. Wisdom in the midst of the ashes means lament and worship, not one or the other. Of course, that's only true if the God we're worshiping can be relied on. If he not only is powerful enough to make something good out of these ashes, but is also committed to doing so for our good. And when we look around us, there seems to be a lot of evidence to the contrary. So how do we know that God can be trusted? That he can be relied on? We know that God can be trusted because as horrible as his story is, Job is not the ultimate example of undeserved suffering. His story is only the preview for the moment when God himself comes to dwell in the ashes with us. Many years after Job died, there was a man in the land of Galilee whose name was Jesus. And that man was blameless and upright, one who feared God and turned away from evil. That man was not just a wise man, but an actually perfect man, one who never sinned in any way, who daily loved justice and did mercy and walked humbly with his God. And Satan saw this man going to and fro about the earth and sought to accuse him, sought to tempt him down the road to foolishness. Satan went to God on high and asked permission to torture this man, and this time God said, "Do not spare his life." And Satan did as he was told. He conspired with the Roman and Jewish leaders to ensure that just as naked Jesus came from his mother's womb, so naked he would hang on the cross. And as he died amidst the ashes, Jesus cried out in wisdom, in worship and in lament, my God, why have you forsaken me?" On that day, the foolishness of Satan was exposed for all to see. He thought, surely Jesus will give all he has in exchange for his life. He never suspected that all along Jesus intended to give his life in exchange for us. On that day, the one person who deserved only good from God received only evil, received all the evil that was coming for you and for me. On that day, God's own Son died the death you and I should have died, so that we might finally live the life we were always meant to live. The life of wisdom. The life of the worship of the one true and living God. On that day, the Father's voice rang out as it never had before. "Have you considered my servant Jesus? That there is none like him in all the earth." Have you? Have you considered Jesus? Have you realized what the cross really means? Have you realized that the cross shows that no matter what you've been through, no matter what ashes are choking you now, whatever sorrows like sea billows have rolled through your soul, Jesus is the God who can be trusted. Jesus is the God who is so committed to your welfare that he comes down into the ashes with you and dies for you. Jesus is the God who is worthy of worship. You and I and everyone else all over the world, we all have to worship something. Have you considered Jesus? There really is none like him in all the earth. Let's pray. Jesus, you and only you are worthy of worship. You and only you are God in the ashes with us. You were pierced for our transgressions. You were crushed for our iniquities. On you fell the chastisement that brings us peace. And by your wounds we are healed. And so we worship you. We worship you with everything we can muster. We admit it is not enough. But what else can we do? There is none like you in all the earth. Amen.